I was writing because I was trying to bring attention to my situation or things that was happening in prisons in general. I was writing for, it was just a lot of desperation. I was writing for a lot of reasons.
You are listening to PEN America's Works of Justice podcast. I am Malcolm Tariq, Senior Manager of Editorial Projects for Prison and Justice Writing, which for over 50 years has amplified the voices of thousands of writers who are creating while incarcerated. Works of Justice spotlights key figures, writers, and artists who are reshaping the conversation on mass incarceration, advocacy, and justice in the United States. In this episode, Prison and Justice Writing Program Assistant Jess Abalafia speaks with Lacino Hamilton about his recently published book, In Spite of the Consequences, Prison Letters on Exoneration, Abolition, and Freedom, composed of letters written during his 26 years of incarceration.
Lacino, thank you so much for joining us here today, and congratulations on publishing this book. How does it feel to hold this collection and have it finally completed?
It feels great, literally like a dream come true.
It really is such an honor, you know, to have you here, and also for PEN America, because you were a writer that our program has worked with when you were behind the walls. So it's really great to be in conversation with you now that you've come home. And from my understanding, this is the 3-year anniversary of your exoneration. And so compared to the time you spent inside, how does it feel to be home and be able to promote this book, which is composed of letters that you wrote while incarcerated?
It feels great. It feels great to have an opportunity to interact with people. It feels great to have an opportunity to talk about abolition. So I'm excited and it does feel wonderful.
Yeah, definitely. So I'd love to hear a little bit more about how this book came into fruition. I know you discuss it at length in the introduction and, you know, some parts throughout the text, but I would love to hear more about how it was created, how it came to be, and how, you know, it came to be published.
Actually, I began working on the book prior to my release. I wanted to have something to try to bring some attention to myself. So I was trying to put a book together. I used to subscribe to Writer's Digest and various other writing publications. I found me an editor, and I was going to try to get the book edited. I had a few friends in academia who kept telling me, don't go that route. They were telling me a book doesn't mean as much when people haven't had the opportunity to review the book, you know, editors and other professional writers. So it feels great to think that what I was trying to publish got published. So when I came home, I believe somebody had suggested that I write an autobiography. And I told him I didn't want to write an autobiography because I didn't want myself to be the primary subject matter. I wanted to talk about prisons. And they explained to me how I could talk about prisons in the book. And I told them that I wanted prisons to be the primary subject matter, not secondary to myself. So I asked them to read those letters that I've been saving over the years. And they thought that it would be something different. They thought it was a good idea. And that's how we basically got this book.
Yeah, that's great. And I know that you mentioned that originally you wanted to publish a collection of your essays, but those essays were thrown out by prison officials. And then that's part of the reason why this book is composed of letters. And so how do you think, you know, the story that you shared throughout this text, how do you think your discussion about abolition would be different if this book was composed of the essays as opposed to the letters? And what makes letters themselves so significant to the story and your mission?
Well, the essays would be different because of the way they would be wrote. I think the letters are, even when I'm not talking about personal matters, they're personal. Often the letters were me commenting on things that was happening right then at the moment. Sometimes when you go back and write an essay, even thinking back on those times, you're not able to capture exactly what you would have said then. And no, that's what those letters do. They capture what I was feeling, what other people was feeling, what I was thinking, what other people was thinking. They capture discussions in real time. And I think that in a lot of ways is better than the essays. It's a little more authenticity, I think, than me going back and trying to think about what to write and researching for books. I'm just people have an opportunity to read, you know, what those moments were like when those moments were happening.
Exactly. And did you write the letters with a broader audience in mind? Like, did you ever think that the letters would be, you know, published or shown to a broader audience, or they were really just between you and the person that you were addressing the letters to?
It was a little bit of both in the sense that the letters were to the people I was writing to, but I was hoping that those letters would motivate people to share my story with other people. Like, I was never just writing to be writing. You know, I always felt like what I put on paper mattered, how people were going to interact with me. Just briefly, I had a lot of different experiences that left real imprints on me. One of them was, I think I was about 2 or 3 years into my imprisonment. I was in segregation. I wrote to Wayne State Law Clinic because I heard that they sometimes will take a case and research it as a class project. And it's doing that, they have helped men and women be exonerated. So I wrote a letter. They wrote me back and told me that they get tens of thousands of letters like mine a year. And unfortunately, they can only help the extraordinary cases. Well, as naive and as ignorant as I was, I didn't believe there was thousands of people in the country like me. I thought that this was like some rare stuff that, you know, and it would shock people when they heard it. But what I ultimately took from that letter was that my situation wasn't as unique as I thought it was. That when I write those letters, that I'm writing the same story that, you know, thousands of other men and women are writing. And it motivated me and encouraged me to want to learn to write better, because I felt that I was going to have to write my way out of there. And I needed those letters to stick out. I needed those letters to have an impact, that telling the same story that other men and women were.
Yeah, definitely. And I would love to hear a little more about your writing journey itself. I know you mentioned in a few letters, you know, your discovery of books was transformative, that led, you know, to you understanding the importance of writing itself. And so I would love to hear a little bit more about your self-education journey and how that led ultimately to you writing thousands and thousands of letters.
It took me about 2 years before they came back with a conviction and I was sent to prison. Within those 2 years, I spent the majority of that time on the mental health floor dealing with depression. Unfortunately, it seems like the prison community, they respond to mental health with medication more so than with counseling or activities that could, you know, assist. So by the time I made it to prison, I was in really bad shape. I know I was lethargical in my movement. I drooled. I said things that were incoherent. I ran into a group called the Melanics. They were a non-denominational Islamic sect with a heavy dose of Black nationalism. But these men, most of them probably 20 years my senior or better, encouraged me to begin reading and writing things in Black history, which was all, for the most part, new to me. But somewhere in reading those books, I kept coming across phrases like economic power, political power, social power, I knew nothing about. So it led me to reach outside of just reading Black history themed books to start sorting abroad and have a greater understanding of what is about politics, economics, social structures. One experience I had I think I've been in prison about 2 or 3 years, and it was the first time I was segregated, which would end up being a 4-year period of segregation. They had just opened up a new max. They had just opened up 2 new housing units in the maximum security prison in Berryville, Michigan, and the department was trying to fill them up. So they was mass busing prisoners from throughout the state to Berwick. Doing that, it took extra time to receive whatever properties we could have. So there was an older gentleman across the hall named Thompson Bay, asked me, did I need anything to read? I said yes. And he sent me over there something called behavior modification units. I never heard of anything like that, read anything like that. And he just encouraged me. He said, man, go on and read that, man. You need to read that. And it was kind of blowing my mind what I was reading. Behavior modification units being another name for segregation, administrative segregation. It was just kind of blowing my mind what they were saying this environment is known to do to people. And that had a big impact on me because after that, I wanted to know everything I could about prison. I mentored a lot of men while I was in prison, young men, black, white, Mexican. It really didn't matter if you was, but I mentored a lot of men. And I had, out of all the things we would talk about, there was always that 4 or 5 or 6 things I felt I needed to impress upon them. And one of them was to study prison. I was explaining to them that you're going to probably meet men who've been in here for various amounts of time, 5, 10. And I would try to explain to them that they know about their day-to-day routines and the patterns and some of the guard interactions. But when it came down to what a sociologist knew, what a penologist knew, what a criminologist knew, and so on, what the science and discipline said about this environment, very few men in prison know anything about it. And I would encourage them that if they studied it, they could possibly build up a defense. That if you know what's happening, if you know some of the likely harms, that maybe there are some sort of mental adjustments or something that you could do to assist you in what those individuals say in this environment, the negative impacts is more than likely to have on you. So, there was a lot of different things that I interacted with a group called the Maoist International Movement based in Ann Arbor, right? And I love that group for a lot of reasons. They invested in prisoners' education. I mean, of course, they had a political view that, sometime overlapped that, but nonetheless, they sent prisoners books in an attempt to educate them. A lot of the international issues that they address talked about some form of oppression taking place around the world. And that sort of broadened my reading. I wanted to learn more about what was going on around the world and how these things were connected. So it wasn't like a linear, like one thing led to the next. There was a variety of different events, a lot of different relationships. I had a lot of friends in academia. Like once I started writing, and once some of my essays began to get published, I began to get pen pals from around the country. A lot of them were college and university professors, and I was exposed to a lot. So a lot of times they would ask me, "What do you want to read, Lucino? And what books would you like?" Most of the time, I would always respond the same way. Just send me whatever you're reading. One, I didn't know a lot about books. I didn't have a way to like go and research and say, I would like to read this book. So that broadened my reading because the men and women who I was pen pals with, they were professors in a lot of different areas. They were reading a lot of different materials. So it was a variety of things that happened. Some of them intentional, some of them not.
So would you reach out to them first, or they contacted you and that's how you cultivated your relationship with your pen pals?
So I tell people that I wrote over 10,000 letters while I was incarcerated. Once again, it's one of those things that sort of happened. I think I've been in prison about 2 or 3 years, and the older younger men to go to the law library, begin researching and learning the law so that you can help fight for your freedom.
Mm-hmm.
But when I went over there, I began to read the law books, and I read some statistics. Again, a lot of this stuff was blowing my mind, that people somewhere was openly discussing these things.
Right.
And they talked about how in Michigan, 90% of the men and women who go through the Court of Appeals will routinely receive no action.
Mm-hmm.
Like, it just don't matter. This is a consistent number. And one of the things I learned about patterns is that patterns represent structure.
Mm-hmm.
It's not random. Something has to be keeping it in place, right? So I began to read, like, how not, in Michigan, the best opportunity you have on appeal is the Court of Appeals. And here the book is saying that 90% of the people will receive no sort of action. The next best opportunity, at least from a prisoner's perspective, that you have for the courts to address your issue is the federal courts. And I was reading how 95% of the people who go through the federal courts receive no action. So early on, I abandoned the appeal process.
Mm-hmm.
I just didn't believe my appeal was based upon me being framed.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I didn't think that the courts would have the courage to admit it, because what they would have to be admitting.
Mm-hmm.
So I abandoned the appeals process and began writing. I just began, at this time, the innocent movement was sort of new. This is back in the early 90s. Journalism schools had a lot of success because classes were taking on cases as projects. So I wrote a lot of journalist schools. I wrote a lot of law schools. The innocent movement was, like I say, sort of in its infancy. I wrote a lot of innocent projects. So
mm-hmm.
I began the process of just writing. And at some point, I just began writing everybody. I felt that what happened to me was egregious.
Mm-hmm.
Like, man, if people just knew what happened, somebody would assist.
Mm-hmm.
So I spent probably 14 to 18 hours, at least the last, I want to say maybe 17 to 18 of those years, reading and writing,
mm-hmm.
hoping that somebody would get one of these letters. Once again, I was writing. As I explained to you, I discovered that there were thousands of men and women like myself writing the same people.
Mm-hmm.
So writing for me, like I say, was a way to try to help my letters stick out.
Mm-hmm.
At some point, that wasn't working, and I wanted to learn how to add some content. You know, maybe if I could show people I could think a little.
Mm-hmm.
I only got a couple paragraphs to do this. So not only content, but I have to learn how to write as well,
mm-hmm.
because I got to learn how to be crafty, to work, to not only tell people I'm innocent and I need help, but also to try to express some form of intelligence by putting some content in it. So you got to learn, you got to teach yourself how to write, because that's a whole lot to do in a couple paragraphs.
Yeah.
So I wrote a lot. Yes, I wrote professors. I got names. I had programs that I liked.
Mm-hmm.
C-SPAN, Book TV was my favorite program. It was a way that I could listen to men and women talk about their books and use it as a way to educate myself. Sometimes people would have contact information, and I would contact them. A lot of times that's where I learned about books. I ordered a lot of books. I would review books on my own and send them to authors. It was really desperation, right? Just hoping I could connect with somebody who would hear my story. And I just always felt that somebody knew what would happen and they would help.
Mm-hmm.
So I spent a lot of time writing. Sometimes people would contact me. Sometimes people would tell people about me. It was a variety of ways.
Mm-hmm.
But I would say majority, it was me reaching out to people and people being kind enough, you know, human enough to reach back.
Mm-hmm. Did you keep a record of the letters you sent? Did you like write copies of them? Because I know some people that I correspond with, they'll write double letters. So they'll send one to me and keep one to themselves. So did you keep that kind of record? How did you keep the letters that ended up in this book and other letters as well?
Sometimes I wrote multiple copies because I typed, so I didn't really handwrite everything.
Okay.
I had a word processor, which is like really a luxury in prison. Really is a luxury in prison. Sometimes I kept letters because of what I talked about in the letter. I may want to talk about it again, and I felt that what I wrote, I wouldn't have to go back and rewrite it. I would keep a copy of that letter, and I could use it as a reference or to refer to it. Sometimes I like what I said, and I would just want to keep the letter. So I kept letters for a variety of reasons.
And so I think a major theme in the book and throughout this conversation so far is that knowledge holds immense power, right? And because of this power, prisons often implement procedures that prevent information from entering the facility, such as, rejecting books, which is something you mentioned in one of your letters to a professor, as well as censoring routine mail. And at Penn, I manage all the incoming mail, and we get hundreds of letters almost weekly. And through this process, I experience censorship every day because a lot of the mail that I send out gets rejected and returned for various reasons, such as, page limits or content. And now mail scanning has a huge impact on our work because states across the country are banning physical mail and turning them into scanned versions. And that contributes to a lot of, censorship and returned mail. And so, because of the amount of mail that we receive, I started a column for our Works of Justice newsletter called Unsealed. Through that column, I aim to celebrate and uplift and, share the creativity that I discover in the mail as we open the envelopes. But I also wanted to expose the challenges that come with maintaining connections between the walls through physical correspondence. And as letters are such a lifeline for people inside, but prisons often make it difficult to maintain those connections. And a few of the columns that I've written about have been about this issue of censorship and the difficulties that come with maintaining routine, correspondence. So despite the significance of letters in this collection and your overall experience in prison, we know that censorship poses a significant challenge to obtaining knowledge and maintaining these connections. So I'd love to take a look at the letter you wrote to one of your pen pals from Australia and hear more about your experiences with mail censorship itself.
Yeah, so this was a letter to a pen pal, and I was on some web site, and had a few pen pals from overseas. But I read the letter. Enclosed is a form rejecting the letter you recently mailed. There is a possibility I may be allowed to read but not possess your letter. This is to be determined at a later date when the mail rejection is reviewed with me by an administrator. The Michigan Department of Corrections mail policy was made more restrictive last October, supposedly to prevent the introduction of contraband into Michigan prisons. It places increased distance between incarcerated people and their family and friends. Soon after most people are incarcerated, they become letter writers. I do not know a prisoner or someone in their family that does not write letters. Letters are the least expensive way to keep in touch. They are also the least immediate, but they are the lifeline for most prisoners. I have had conversations with prisoners that have shared with me that letters are almost a requirement for their sanity. Yet some people here do not receive any mail at all. Some prisoners are illiterate, and some of their family members are also, like my father. He dropped out of school in the third grade, which carried him through life. I imagine that when an incarcerated person and people who wish to support him or her are both illiterate, that it is like being confined twice. The exchange of ideas and feelings are not often expressed, even when one can write well. This is self-censorship. All incarcerated people are aware that prison staff read letters going in. On a slow day, a bored guard may read an entire letter. No one wants someone knowing their most intimate thoughts to someone else. That lessens the ease of writing. Incarcerated people are always on guard about putting what they want to say most to family and friends into letters. Because of this, spontaneity is lost. It is unlikely to happen, but if incarcerated women were permitted to participate in the crafting of mail policies, perhaps important things like this could be taken into consideration. If incarcerated people were consulted in an honest way, there would be far less opposition to rules. Several years ago, I tutored for the University of Michigan Dearborn campus inside our prison exchange program. At the beginning of each semester, I'm going to leave it there as far as they're going to talk about censorship.
Did you experience a lot of censorship with your letters? Did a lot of them get rejected or?
So the insanity of it is I was in prison like 27 years. I never got in a fight. I never had any type of violence in my jacket, anything like that. But I spent majority of my time in prison, either in segregation, maximum security placement, or on something called security threat group status, which I express to people is the Michigan Department of Corrections version of the things I've read about happening in Guantanamo Bay. Being on that status, I was on that status about 7 years. Being on that status, everything that I did had to be everything I wrote, every phone call, every letter, everything went through some super security status. And by me being an abolitionist, it's like everything that I got was damn near rejected. Just to talk about this in a broader sense real quickly, it's easier to control ignorant people than it is informed people, right? It's easier to control men and women who are ignorant, who don't know, who don't have a way to find out, who are isolated. So yes, I experienced censorship. It seemed like every day I was in there, and even self-censorship. I wrote freely, but I didn't. I wanted things to get out of there. You know, I wanted to receive some things. So I would try to find ways to get information out. So I sometimes had to be creative with my language. I had to be creative with the things that I had people sending in to me. So yeah, censorship, I think in any situation where people are being oppressed and incarcerated men and women are being oppressed, in every oppressive situation, you're going to find censorship. Prison is an oppressive situation. And censorship is a major aspect of one being incarcerated.
Definitely. And do you think the censorship, whether it's, you know, censorship from the prison or self-censorship, how did that affect the relationships between you and the people that you wrote letters to?
I can't even put that in words. Like how it affected it. It affected it in so many different. I lost contact with a lot of people. Because the prison limits the way that you can communicate. One of the things, being on that jacked up security status I said I was on, I could only have 5 phone calls a week that were 15 minutes in duration. Most people, if they could only call 5 people a week for 15 minutes in duration, it would be a lot of people they would lose contact with. It would be a lot of people they wouldn't talk to as much. It would be a lot of people they wouldn't be as close to as much. I mean, people could just, without me having the words to express that, I would just ask people to think about if you could only talk to 5 people a week for 15 minutes within those 5 phone calls, how do you think it would affect your relationships?
Definitely. And what was it like writing to someone who you've never met in person? Like you said, you wrote thousands of letters, and a lot of your relationships were strictly through physical mail. So how do you navigate their relationship through correspondence, especially when writing between the walls and through different geographical or cultural contexts?
One, just to be honest with you, I wasn't shy. Like I wasn't in a position where I could be shy.
Yeah.
You know, I had to be in a position where I had to learn how to make introductions, right, with people I probably didn't have much in common with. Like you say, a stranger. People, most of the people who are busy. You know, that's something that, you know, people getting thousands of letters a year, they probably don't have time to sit down and read all those letters and give them the attention that they want. It came a point where I really didn't have a problem writing letters. The letters meant so much to me. One of the things I've learned since I've been out of prison is just how disconnected with the world I was. That's why most of those letters in there are to pen pals, people that I did not know prior to my incarceration. It was just difficult. Let me put it like that. But I wasn't shy about it. I always felt like, as I told you, I didn't exercise the appeals process. Writing was the way that I thought that I might be able to help obtain my freedom. I always felt I was writing for my freedom. I was desperate. There's a lot of desperation in those letters, if people ever picked that up out of those letters or not. You know, whatever I was talking about, I was writing for a variety of reasons. You know, I was writing because I was happy to have somebody to write. I was happy writing because I was trying to educate myself. I was writing because I was trying to bring attention to my situation or things that was happening in prisons in general. I was writing for, it was just a lot of desperation. I was writing for a lot of reasons.
Yeah, definitely. And I think now it might be a good time to transition to discussing language itself, because we know based on your conversation and throughout the book, writing is important, but so are the words you use when writing, right? So in several moments throughout the collection, you discuss the importance of being intentional with language used to talk about incarceration, abolition, the system at large. And I'm a big believer in language holding immense power and it being able to shape thought, which is why myself and the rest of the prison and justice writing team at Penn, we reject state language like inmate, convict, felon, prisoner, in order to combat the erasure of individuals inside and also prevent reinforcing these systems of oppression that rely on language that is used to separate and divide and maintain these structures of oppression. And in one of your letters to Rhonda, you write that some people think the problem is mass incarceration and not just incarceration. And that specifically was a really powerful moment for me because I had not really considered the distinction before reading that. And I'm just used to using the term mass incarceration when talking about, you know, abolitionist ideas. But once you pointed that out, I really thought that, yeah, mass incarceration is a problem, but also so is incarceration, period, right? So I would love to hear more of your thoughts about being intentional with language and how that might catalyze meaningful change in regards to abolishing the prison industrial complex. And you could feel free to read parts of the letter, including, you know, one with Lisa, to discuss your thoughts on this.
So always tell people, and I mean this as sincerely as I can say it, and there's no modesty in it, I never considered myself to be a good writer. Even when I was being, people out being published, I was being paid to write some of the articles or essays that was being published. Even that being said, I never thought that what I was writing was good writing. I read so much in there, right? And I used to read some great writing. Always thought that what people were asking me for was not my, you know, literary skills per se, but my perspectives. That what I was talking about, I might have been talking about it a little bit different than what others were. And my perspectives were based upon my experiences, what I was going through. So it became important for me to constantly develop my perspectives, per se, to work on my perspectives, how I would express myself, how I would try to get these points across. I understood that language was important and that, like a lot of things in this country, language has been commodified. You know, sometimes we forget that we're talking about people. So I talk about things not being gravity. You know, the healthcare system is in gravity. The educational system is in gravity. I try to use that language Because what I'm trying to get people to understand is if it's not gravity, then it's something that we can do something about.
Exactly. Yep.
This is not something that can't be changed, altered, done away with. You know, so I think abolition is about the most extreme position you can ask someone to take. But I think it's the most sensible and human thing that we can do. For an example, when I began to study what the scientists and the different disciplines had to say about incarceration and how they know it harms people, right? So understanding that it harms people, I talk about it in that language. And I talk about, when I talk about abolition, I talk about ending harm. And most of the times when a person is in a situation where they're being harmed, people think about how to end that harm immediately. People don't negotiate. So it's important to be intentional because the results that we want are intentional. You know,
Exactly.
we want specific results. We want people to stop being harmed. We want a system, even though we don't know exactly what that looks like. We want something that's worthy of who we are as humans. We want something that restores. We want something that transforms. We don't want something that just punishes.
A lot of the language surrounding abolition is about destruction and tearing things down, but truly understanding the foundational idea of abolition means understanding that abolition is really about rebuilding and cultivating a society where people can live free and healthy lives, you know, and have the resources they need to thrive. So abolition is not about destruction. It's really the opposite. And it's about, like you said, rebuilding and transforming and not criminalizing and punishing people for things that most of the time aren't even their fault. It's really a product of being deprived, you know, of institutional resources, and then they're criminalized for it. And so, yeah, I also agree. It's really important to be intentional with language when talking about real issues, but also ideas and theories as well, especially abolition.
I usually tell people that part of my responsibility is to make abolition not sound crazy. A lot of people have the ideas that they have about abolition because they haven't talked to abolitionists.
Exactly. Yeah.
They haven't studied and worked or been around abolitionists. See, people have already been conditioned to think about a lot of things in our society in certain ways. So, I mean, we have to be intentional because me personally, part of my goal is to create a different world, a world designed for humans.
Yep.
And if we're going to design a different world, we're going to have to start thinking different. And if we're going to start thinking different, we're probably going to start using different language, different ideas, concepts, different authorities. So, I mean, I know I got a little long-winded on that, but it's super important.
Yeah, we could talk a whole hour about language itself because of how important it is, you know? So, no, your answer was perfect. But I do want to wrap up with one last question, and that is, what advice do you have for writers who are still inside or for writers who are have recently come home or planning to return home soon? What advice do you have for them?
Well, my advice would be what I would tell men and women when I was incarcerated and I'm like mentor to correspondent, I would tell them to keep writing. I would say that practice doesn't necessarily make perfect, but it makes better. You're likely to learn. You know, I tell people to keep old writings so they can go back and look at them. I wrote 10,000 letters. I was never gonna stop. Stay true to it, you know, in spite of the consequences. Determination and resilience. There's going to be some obstacles, but you got to keep it up. PEN America was one of the few places that I could say had a constant presence in the Michigan Department of Corrections that see the value in what's inside of our minds and our heads and give us the space. I do believe one or two things that I wrote before was published by PEN America. That was like me winning the lotto. It meant something to know that somebody seen value in me because I was in an environment where I was devalued. Nobody who has anything to do with running prisons or cares about what a prisoner thinks. So when somebody shows interest in what I think, and not only shows interest, goes as far as to publish it and share it with others, I'm telling you, those sort of letters always, I mean, I was geeked every time I got a letter like that. Mm-hmm. It meant so. I wanted to show it to every other prisoner.
Mm-hmm.
I wanted to write my pen pals and to tell my pen pals, Pen America published something of mine.
Yeah.
So it means so much. I know it meant a lot to me.
Mm-hmm.
And I know I wasn't the only one with those letters showing it to people, you know, or trying to look. I looked at that as a great accomplishment. Pen mm-hmm. America is not small to the men and women incarcerated.
Mm.
You know, so I appreciate, like I say, now to be out here on the other side of those gates, trying to continue that struggle and to do an interview, it means a lot, you know.
Mm-hmm. And it means a lot to us to be able to have this conversation and to have you here. And especially for me, when Malcolm first showed me this book, I saw the word letters and I got so excited. And then I was even more excited to see the whole book was composed of letters because, you know, like I said, my main role at Penn is writing letters all day, answering people. And also, you know, outside of Penn, I write to people in prison. And I know how much letter writing, you know, means and how significant that is and having that tangible connection. So I was so happy when Malcolm presented me with this opportunity. And it has been such an honor to talk to you and learn a bit more about your story and discuss abolition, which is really important, you know. So thank you so much
Yes, ma'am.
For being here.
I appreciate that. Thank you.
This episode of Works of Justice was produced by Malcolm Tariq. Music used throughout this episode was created by B.L. Sherrill and Fury Young of Die Jim Crow Records, the nation's first nonprofit record label for formerly and currently incarcerated artists. You can subscribe to and hear previous episodes of Works of Justice on any podcast platform, including Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, and Spotify. To learn more about Penn America's prison and justice writing, please visit penn.org/works of justice. That's PEN.org/works of justice.